Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and even casual sci-fi fans will recognize the trope of a man-made animal, be it the mutations from The Hunger Games or Margaret Atwood's Chicky Knobs in Oryx and Crake. But with Dayglow goldfish and cloned livestock now a reality, science journalist Emily Anthus argues that scientifically engineered creatures have come out of the laboratory and into our lives. Her new book is Frankenstein's Cat, Cuddling Up to Biotech's Brave New Beasts. And she joins us now. Emily Anthus, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks.
So genetic manipulation of animals is nothing new, maybe is the first thing we should say about that. We have all the different breeds of dogs as proof. So what's different about doing it in the lab, and where does technology come in?
Well, our new molecular techniques amplify our powers. They give us the power to manipulate DNA directly instead of having to guess through selective breeding. We can change animals much faster than we could before and in new ways by, for instance, moving genes from one species into another.
Is that like animal testing, which is already so controversial? Like, how do we cuddle up to using biotechnology on animals, as your title suggests?
Well, it depends. I mean, my point is that these techniques are nuanced and that there are certainly ways in which we can abuse our new powers and create, say, animal welfare problems, but we can also use these techniques for good. We can create disease-resistant animals. We can treat blindness in dogs. We can replace injured limbs in pets. There are all sorts of ways we can do good.
So, for example, you've written about the FDA's 17-year delay in deciding whether or not to approve transgenic salmon that grows twice as fast as so-called real salmon. You say they should give it the seal of approval for human consumption. How come?
Well, so far, all the evidence suggests that it's safe, that it's as low risk as food gets. There's nothing to suggest it's going to cause human health problems, environmental problems. I mean, nothing is ever 100% guaranteed, but that goes for conventional foods that are already on the market.
And you write that the AquaVantage salmon, as it's called, would be the first transgenic creature to officially enter our food supply. So are we already consuming creatures like this unofficially?
I didn't mean to suggest that, but I guess I was just hedging my bets a little bit. You never know maybe what's going on in China or other countries. Things might have, sort of slipped in, but I think that's unlikely.
And there's been a lot of talk about labeling GM produce. Whole Foods recently pledged to do so voluntarily, even though Prop 37, which would have required it, didn't pass in California in the last election. If consuming GM meat is an option, do you think it should be clearly indicated on packaging?
I don't think it's necessary, and I think in many ways it can be misleading. It would suggest that there's something different or dangerous about these GM foods, and so far all the tests suggest that not only is GM food not dangerous, but it is literally indistinguishable from other food. So to slap a GMO designation on a product, I mean, if companies want to disclose that voluntarily, I'm all for it. But I think to mandate it is unnecessary and misleading.
Although what advocates of the labeling argue is that we don't know the long-term consequences of these kinds of genetic modifications on the environment as much as on human health. So there may be no evidence that GM foods are unhealthy in, you know, the direct sense of eating it and something's going to go wrong with our bodies. But it's a hot button issue for a reason. And so people should at least have the opportunity in a democracy to know what they're eating if they have concerns.
Sure. And I'm sympathetic to that argument. But I think just slapping the letters GMO on a product is not informative. If you want to create an informative label, it should say, this is how the product was genetically modified and why. And here's what the data show about safety. And here's what we do know and don't know. How you get that all in a label, I don't know. But that's what an informative label looks like.
So, listeners, what are your personal boundaries when it comes to animals and biotechnology? Would you clone a beloved pet? Does genetically modified salmon sound appealing, especially if it means less guilt about the environment? Call now at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 for science journalist Emily Anthes. Her new book is Frankenstein's Cat, Cuddling Up to Biotech's Brave New Beasts. And the title is, of course, so provocative. And yet, I think the main point that you're making is that people are irrationally afraid of some of these things.
Yes. I mean, I guess irrational is a good word. I don't want to make it seem like I'm not sympathetic to the fears, because certainly some of these advances unsettle me, and I understand that these are profound new powers we have. But I also think that we have an obligation to look at them rationally instead of just having emotional knee-jerk reactions.
When you talk about, in the book, adding in green fluorescent protein to make certain animals glow, it seems kind of trivial. So what's the goal with manipulating animal genetics in a case like that? Does it have implications for human health, or put that, you know, headline that people may have heard of in some context for us?
Right. So, for instance, there are these glowing fish that you can now buy as pets, and that's trivial, but that's not why the technology was developed. Fluorescent proteins are really useful for researchers because they allow them to actually visualize animal development. They can see genes turn on and off throughout the course of development. They answer all sorts of questions about organismal biology. And so that's why researchers have been doing this research. In this particular case, some entrepreneurs came along and licensed the technology to create pets, but that's not why it was developed.
And there are opponents of this too, this kind of genetically modifying of animals on ethical grounds, even though there are no indications here, as with GM foods, that there's necessarily any harm. But I guess people are concerned about the impact on other gene expression that might take place over many generations, correct?
Well, I'm not sure that's the concern as much as there are two main concerns you hear with those fish. And one is the impact they might have on the environment, say if a little kid flushed them down the toilet and they got free. The other is just sort of the more philosophical argument that it's trivial and unnatural and that we shouldn't be meddling with animals just to make them our pets.
Is there concern about what happens if genetically modified animals mate with natural animals?
Absolutely. And I think a lot of the ecological concerns are totally legitimate and worth serious scrutiny. In some of these cases, like the GM salmon, those fish are sterile, so that's not a real risk there. In the case of these glowfish, they're tropical fish that are unlikely to survive in, you know, North American waters. But in general, that's a real concern.
And you touch on what you call robo-beasts, such as a cyborg cockroach that can be controlled by humans with a neural remote control. Are we talking about animal drones?
That is what DARPA was essentially talking about when they set out to fund the research. You know, they're not ready to be used for that, and whether they ever actually get used for that is unclear, but that was one of the proposed applications.
Could this technology ever be used on humans?
You mean to create remote-controlled humans?
Yeah.
I mean, scientifically, I'm sure it could be. I don't think anyone's legitimately proposing that.
Let's take a few phone calls. Our board is actually packed with people reacting to one piece or another of what our guest science journalist Emily Anthes is discussing with respect to her new book, Frankenstein's Cat, Cuddling Up to Biotech's Brave New Beasts. And Ian in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, good day. I just was wondering if she could comment on the impact GMOs have on the farming and agricultural community, you know, especially in regards to companies that produce a lot of the chemicals that are dependent to raise a lot of the farming and the seeds specifically that they have to produce. Also, being someone from Texas, we see a large impact that subsidies have, and what specifically they would have to cost us as a taxpayer more money in the future, if any, do you speculate?
The GM seed issue, I'm not super expert on. I'm more on the animal side, but the overuse of pesticides and sort of the creation, I think you're talking about weeds that are maybe even more resistant to these chemicals, is absolutely a concern. But as far as I know, it's not a concern limited to the use of GM seeds. It's a problem with the overuse of pesticides on any sorts of crops. In terms of the subsidy issue, that's actually not one I've looked into, but a lot of this research does get federal funding, and it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
And Monsanto is before the Supreme Court right now on the question of who owns plants, who owns seeds.
Right.
In the book, you also cover less controversial applications of technology to animals, such as using tracking devices on wildlife or creating high-tech prosthetics. How do these instances fit together with, say, cloning cats?
Well, to me, they're all part and parcel of this new power, new technology we have to totally reinvent and essentially re-engineer animal bodies. And maybe that's cloning and maybe that's genetic modification, but that also involves creating bionic legs for pet dogs or implanting sensors in the bellies of bluefin tuna. These are all sort of new ways in which we're interacting with animals.
If we associate these thornier biotech issues with cute pictures of dogs in wheelchairs, does it make cloning or GM meat somehow easier to swallow?
Maybe. I mean, that wasn't my intention. My intention was more to show that these technologies are multifaceted and they can be used in all these different ways. And so there aren't easy ethical answers to some of these questions.
Does the prominence of biotech creatures in science fiction give the whole idea a bad rap? Are they less freaky in real life? And even the title of your book, Frankenstein's Cat, kind of, I think, reflects general public horror before people drill down on the facts.
Right. I mean, I think they do sometimes get a bad rap, but I think sci-fi has also played an important role in getting maybe our imaginations going in a good way and thinking about what might be possible. Certainly my experience in meeting some of these cloned animals and GM animals is that what's remarkable about them is how unremarkable they are. They look just like normal creatures.
Amy in Fanwood, you're on WNYC. Hi, Amy.
Hi, good morning. I am calling in. I'm a vegan, and foods that are not labeled as GM concern me because I know they're sometimes taking things like genes from fish and putting them in plants to make them more water resistant. I want to know that my foods are not combining genes from fish. I want totally vegan food.
Is it true that fish material would wind up in plant life in some of the scenarios that you write about?
I mean, it's certainly possible. It's not one of the scenarios I've written about, but that's why I think if we want to have a truly informative GMO label, that's why you need to say how it's been modified, what gene is in there. There have certainly been concerns, for instance, with allergens. There was a case where they were talking about putting a gene from a nut into a plant. And of course, that's dangerous for people with nut allergies. So if you really want information about these products, you have to drill down and not just say it's GM, but how it's modified and with what genes.
Well, scientifically engineered creatures, like it or not, are coming out of the laboratory and into our lives. And science journalist Emily Anthes has chronicled some of it in her new book, Frankenstein's Cat, Cuddling Up to Biotech's Brave New Beasts. Thank you so much for talking about it with us.
Thanks for having me.
And a quick follow-up. On Wednesday of last week, we talked about genetics and privacy as part of our Ask a Bioethicist series. And 23andMe, the company that will sequence your genome for a fee, came up in the conversation. And on the comments page on our website, there was some confusion about if it was available to New Yorkers. So we looked that up to clear it up. We called 23andMe, and here's the answer we got from them. Quote, while 23andMe is authorized to ship sample collection kits to the state of New York, 23andMe is currently unable to process saliva samples collected in or mailed from the state of New York. The New York Department of Health considers our personal genome service a test requiring a lab license and direct physician involvement. You or the recipient of the saliva kit must collect your sample and mail it from outside the state of New York. Upon receipt of your saliva kit, you or the recipient will be required to affirm under penalty of law that the sample for the saliva kit has not been collected in or mailed from the state of New York unquote. So that statement from 23andMe, for those of you interested in having your genome sequenced, and for those of you in New Jersey or Connecticut, no restrictions of this sort, just New York.